Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 182. It's Monday, October 10th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's start with a couple short COVID stories in our local update. As it looks like Lucas County is starting a surge, probably the fall surge here. But let's start with this from MedPage today. Healthcare workers unhappy about new CDC mask guidance. Hospital and healthcare workers aren't pleased with updated CDC recommendations to drop universal masking in healthcare settings. Late last week, the agency quietly published new guidance that scrapped universal masking for healthcare workers. Now, hospitals and nursing homes in areas without high COVID-19 transmission rates can opt out of requiring doctors, patients, and visitors to mask up. While the recommendation is tied to local transmission rates rather than the community levels used for public masking recommendations, some 30% of the U.S. currently falls outside the areas with high transmission, according to CDC's COVID data tracker. Mark Howell, Director of Policy and Patient Safety at the American Hospital Association, said the organization, quote, understands why CDC chose to focus on using transmission data to guide masking decisions for healthcare workers, but noted that healthcare workers in much of the U.S. would still need to mask up. These changes reflect the importance of mitigating challenges related to COVID-19 as early as possible and keeping health workers and the patients they treat safe and healthy, a goal hospitals and health systems strongly share with the CDC, Howell said. Current levels of high community transmission across the country mean universal masking is recommended in most communities for everyone in a healthcare setting, especially when in areas of the healthcare facility where they could encounter patients. Megan Rainey of Brown University offered stronger criticism of the guidance on Twitter. She said the CDC's logic, quote, escapes me. As it pertains to society's most health vulnerable people in a setting with higher than average risk of COVID positivity. Universal masking decreases transmission of COVID-19, Rainey tweeted, adding that her own hospital in Rhode Island has experienced staff absences due to COVID. Former U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams tweeted that CDC's, quote, nuanced have your cake and eat it too approach hasn't worked a single time throughout the pandemic. People just hear no more masks. The @CDCGov account could have said, we will continue to follow local transmission rates carefully and make adjustments to the recommendations when the data warrants reconsideration, he added. Yet the effusive industry praise makes it seem as though there was political pressure to end masks now. Of course, COVID data collection and guidelines seem to be going by the wayside. This from Medical Express. CDC drops COVID travel advisories as countries stop tracking cases. The CDC is dropping its foreign travel advisories for COVID. The agency explained that because so many countries have stopped tracking their COVID cases, it can no longer accurately calculate health risk to travelers. So it doesn't mean that they wouldn't warn if they were high levels. It's just that we don't know because countries aren't keeping track of the data anymore. So, hey, if you don't measure it, it's not happening, right? But the CDC does say Americans should still keep up with their vaccines and follow CDC recommendations for international travel, including practicing usual precautions, taking enhanced precautions, or avoiding non-essential travel, depending on the destination, the agency said. Okay, well, time for the Lucas County COVID-19 update. Basically, Lucas County is back in the high transmission category. We've had a big jump of cases in the last couple weeks. We're up to an average number of identified cases, 133 a day, up from 73 a couple weeks ago. Big jump. Looks like Lucas County might be leading the way regionally as far as a fall surge. Cases still remain high in long-term care facilities or nursing homes. We had 82 active cases in Lucas County long-term care facilities. That's down slightly from 92 a couple weeks ago, but is high historically, meaning over the last couple months or so. Good news, hospitalizations in the U.S. and Ohio continue to decline. This is benefiting from a slow drop in cases recently. And related to that, as you'd expect, with cases going down somewhat, deaths have dipped to below 400 per day, which is the first time it's done that in a while. We've been sticking stubbornly above that level the whole summer, pretty much. But as fall is coming, we're going to see cases go back up, and we'll probably, unfortunately, be back above that 400 deaths a day relatively soon. Okay, well, I haven't reported on vaccination levels in the U.S., Ohio, and Lucas County actually for 13 weeks. Well, that's because not much is happening. Even with the new boosters available and the basic series being available for over a year, what we've seen over the last 13 weeks is about a 1% increase in the number of people fully vaccinated and about a 1% increase in the number of the population that's actually been boosted at all. I've had three boosters. This is just for people who've gotten one of those three or more. And Ohio and Lucas County have done worse than nationally. Ohio and Lucas County have increased by less than 1% the number of people fully vaccinated or that have gotten boosted over the last 13 weeks. Wow, that is slowed to a crawl. And unfortunately, Lucas County does worse than both Ohio, and Ohio does worse than the U.S. And as far as the new bivalent COVID booster that's been brought out just ahead of a predicted winter surge, only about 4% of eligible Americans have gotten this new bivalent COVID booster. Yikes. That means people that have gotten one or even two boosters before, those are starting to wane. We're not very well positioned for a winter surge. Okay, well, in our last COVID news story, this from Fierce Healthcare related to COVID vaccines. We're seeing a shift as the federal government is running out of money and is shifting out of the public health emergency phase, and those costs will now be shifted to commercial insurance plans. So what does that mean? And also, what does it mean as far as costs and hospitalizations and lives lost depending on vaccination rates coming up? As I've indicated, we're not doing a good job out of the gate here. So this from Fierce Healthcare. How much commercial plans could save if COVID vaccines increase? If 80% of eligible Americans got fully vaccinated between now and March 31st, 2023, the medical cost savings could come to $34 billion for those who receive the treatment through commercial health plans, according to a new Commonwealth Fund report. If the uptake of bivalent and other COVID-19 vaccines match the uptake for influenza vaccines, which actually are historically pretty low, maybe about 50%, the medical cost savings would come to $27 billion for individuals in commercial insurance plans. These are just two of the highlights of the report, which calculates the lives and money that could be saved or lost under three possible scenarios. If the rate of vaccine uptake continues as is, if the rate matches the last year's flu vaccine rate, and if 80% of eligible American adults were fully vaccinated, these are the three scenarios. The paper updates one that researchers unveiled in July, except this one estimates what could be saved according to payer, either through Medicaid, Medicare, or commercial insurance companies. The Biden administration is in the process of ending free distribution of COVID-19 vaccines and tests and shifting those costs to commercial insurance plans. If 80% of eligible Americans got fully vaccinated between October 1st and March 31st of next year, it could save $56 billion in direct medical costs. In addition, 90,000 lives would be saved and more than 936,000 hospitalizations averted. If 80% of eligible Americans got the booster shot, the savings in direct medical costs for Medicare would be $13.5 billion, and for Medicaid it would be $4.5 billion. You notice that means even under this high vaccination rate, which is higher than what's likely to actually happen, the vast majority of the savings is going to come through commercial insurance plans, $34 billion as opposed to less than half that from Medicare and Medicaid. Under both scenarios modeled, we found an aggressive fall booster vaccination campaign could prevent COVID-19 deaths from exceeding 400 per day, the report states. We'll see if that happens. And of course, we're in flu season now, so this from the National Foundation for Infectious Disease, U.S. health officials urge vaccination to help protect against a potentially severe flu season. With a potentially severe respiratory season ahead, about half of all U.S. adults remain vulnerable to flu, according to new data released by the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. The new survey of U.S. adults found that only 49% plan to get a flu vaccine during the current flu season. Leading health experts and the CDC are urging everyone aged 6 months and older to get vaccinated against flu now, amid concerns of a potentially severe season in the U.S. According to the survey, a majority, 69% of U.S. adults, recognize that annual flu vaccination is the best preventive measure against flu-related hospitalizations and deaths. Furthermore, most adults, 58%, report that they will wear a mask at least sometimes during flu season, a preventive behavior that represents a major change compared to pre-pandemic flu seasons. Based on what we've seen in parts of the Southern Hemisphere, flu has the potential to hit us hard, said the National Foundation for Infectious Disease Medical Director William Schaffner. On a positive note, we have more preventive behaviors in our toolbox than we did before the COVID-19 pandemic. We are more accustomed to wearing masks and staying home when sick. And another vaccination news, this from the CDC, rate of monkeypox cases by vaccination status. Unvaccinated people had 14 times the risk of monkeypox disease compared to people who were vaccinated. So apparently the vaccine works very well. But of course, it's not necessarily evenly distributed. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Monkeypox case rates 5 times higher in Black Americans. A new report from the Kaiser Family Foundation based on CDC data reveals that monkeypox case rates in the U.S. disproportionately affect Black and Latino Americans, with Black Americans having case rates 5 times of those found among their white peers. Racial inequity is also at play in monkeypox vaccine distribution. As of September 27th, over half, 51%, of monkeypox first doses of vaccination have gone to white people, although they represent only 30% of reported cases. In contrast, despite accounting for more than a third of cases, 35%, only 13% of first doses have been administered to Black people. And in more public health news, disproportionately affecting Black folks, this from the New York Times. Gun-related suicides and killings continued to rise in 2021, the CDC reports. Homicides and suicides involving guns, which soared in 2020, the first year of the pandemic, continued rising in 2021, reaching the highest rate in 3 decades, the CDC reported. Firearms caused over 47,000 homicide and suicide deaths in 2021, from just under 44,000 in 2020, according to agency research, which is based on provisional data. Rates of gun-related homicide and suicide each rose by 8.3% last year. Including unintentional deaths and those related to law enforcement activities, the total number of gun deaths in the U.S. was 48,832 in 2021, according to a separate analysis by Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. Everyone is talking about the rise in homicides, but is largely driven by guns, said Ari Davis, a policy advisor at the center. Yet gun suicides also drove an overall rise in suicides. An 8% increase in gun suicides over 1 year is a really large increase, Mr. Davis said. It's very worrisome. From 2019 to 2021, homicides involving guns increased by 45%, while murders that did not involve firearms increased by only 6%. While gun-related suicides increased by 10% over the 2-year period, suicides by other means decreased by about 8%, according to analysis. So part of it was just a shift from other methods of guns, but of course, since guns are the most deadly form of suicide, the actual overall rates did increase. Americans went on... Although the CDC research does not address the underlying causes, the increase in firearm deaths parallels a spike in gun purchases during the pandemic, including an increase in first-time owners. Americans went on a gun-buying spree in 2020 that continued into 2021, when in a single week, the Federal Bureau of Investigation reported a record 1.2 million background checks. Purchasers often turn to handguns for self-protection, but research has shown that having a firearm in the home dramatically raises the risk of gun death, including both homicides and suicides. And I would note, as I've reported on earlier, a lot of this is a massive increase in the number of homes that newly have a firearm. You know, if you're adding the second, third, fourth, 20th, 23rd firearm, it doesn't have as much of an effect on the ability to for homicides and suicides. But if you're getting the first gun, it's a massive thing for moving from zero to one gun. Okay. Other disruptive aspects of the pandemic may also have contributed to increased violence, said Thomas Simon, the lead author of the CDC research. There have been changes and disruptions in services, in education, increased mental stress and isolation, and economic stressors, all related to COVID. He added, we also had concerns in a lot of communities about law enforcement's use of lethal force and tension and distrust of law enforcement. So there may have been an impact on the community's willingness to engage with law enforcement. Domestic violence may have also increased during the pandemic, Dr. Simon said. Gun deaths rose among both men and women in 2021, though men still made up the majority of gun-related victims and suicides. Young adults aged 25 to 44 were the most likely to be killed with a firearm. And while there were increases in gun homicides among all racial and ethnic groups last year, the rise was primarily concentrated in Black and Hispanic communities. Black people continue to experience the highest gun homicide rates in every age group. The racial disparity is particularly acute among youngsters and young adults aged 10 to 24. The firearm homicide rate among Black youngsters and young adults in 2020 was already 20 times higher than among white young people. In 2021, the gap widened as gun homicides among white youngsters decreased slightly, and the rate of firearm homicides among Black young people is now almost 25 times as high. My God, there's few things in public health that you see that have that huge of a gap. This is an example of an unacceptable disparity that has continued to go in the wrong direction, Dr. Simon said. It's possible that stressors associated with the pandemic, which we know hit racial and ethnic communities harder in many areas, could be contributing to these inequities. Overall, Black and Hispanic Americans were almost 14 times and 2.5 times, respectively, as likely to die in a gun homicide as white people in 2021, the largest difference in over a decade. Suicides involving firearms increased by only 1% during the first year of the pandemic, but soared in 2021, increasing from just over 24,000 in 2020 to over 26,000 in 2021, the highest one-year increase reported by the CDC and a record high. The increase occurred among both men and women and in most age, racial, and ethnic groups. Gun-related suicides have long been more common among older white men. And in 2021, more than 80% of all gun suicides were among white Americans. Those aged 45 and older had the highest gun suicide rates. But Black and Hispanic Americans accounted for the greatest increases in gun suicide rates overall from 2020 to 2021. And Native American and Alaska Native people had the highest gun-related suicide rate among adults under 45 years of age. Okay, well, not addressing public health problems is very costly, and I got a series of stories that will get at that in depth. First up from Medical Express, smoking costs U.S. economy almost $900 billion, that's with a B, $900 billion a year. Smoking isn't only costly in terms of health risk, it also cost the U.S. economy $891 billion in 2020. That was almost 10 times the cigarette industry's $92 billion revenue, according to the authors of a new American Cancer Society study. Economic losses from cigarette smoking far outweigh any economic benefit from the tobacco industry. Wages and salaries of those employed by the industry, tax revenue, and industry profit combined, said Dr. Niger Nargis, Senior Scientific Director of Tobacco Control Research at the Cancer Society. As a society, we can mitigate these economic losses through coordinated and comprehensive evidence-based tobacco control measures, which encourage people to quit smoking and prevent people from starting to smoke in the first place. Well, folks, if you or someone you know is a smoker who's interested in quitting, you can call the Ohio Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Okay, well, next up, an even more costly public health epidemic, this from Reuters. Opioid crisis cost U.S. nearly $1.5 trillion, that's with a T, $1.5 trillion in 2020, says a congressional report. Fueled by the COVID-19 pandemic, the economic toll of the opioid addiction and overdose crisis in the United States reached nearly $1.5 trillion in 2020 alone and is likely to grow, congressional reports seen by Reuters shows. Opioid-related deaths soared during the pandemic, including from the powerful synthetic painkiller fentanyl, exacerbating an already tragic and costly nationwide crisis and accounting for 75% of the 107,000 drug overdose fatalities in 2021, according to the CDC. It's equivalent to one 737 jet every day going down, no survivors. It's a mind-boggling number of deaths, said Representative David Trone, who sits on the Congressional Joint Economic Committee that issued the report. The latest calculation represents a 37% increase from 2017, when the CDC last measured the cost. And back to gun violence, this from Medical Express. The business case for reducing gun violence. While gun violence in the United States continues to claim lives at an alarming rate, it is also taking a quiet toll on the U.S. economy, according to new research by Zuri Song, Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at the Blavatnik Institute at Harvard Medical School and Associate Professor of Medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital. In his newest paper, published in JAMA, Song reports that the overall economic cost of firearm injuries in the United States is some $557 billion, or 2.6% of gross domestic product. 88% of this cost is attributed to quality of life losses among those injured by firearms and their families. Yet, Song said, the business case for reducing firearm injuries has remained largely unaddressed. Aside from added spending, losses in revenue and productivity are estimated to cost private employers $535 million per year nationwide. Employers also face the physical and mental consequences. Workers who survive firearm injuries experience a 40% increase in pain disorders, a 51% increase in psychiatric disorders, and an 85% increase in substance use disorders. And while the last article makes a business case for dealing with a public health issue, this next article gets at the heart of it. This from Stat News. The U.S. is terrible at keeping businesses from worsening public health, experts say. Here in the U.S., it's in to study the social determinants of health, thank goodness. There are programs at Columbia and Emory dedicated to the field. Papers on the topic garner thousands of citations. The Federal Health Department has even crafted an entire plan for addressing this topic, which is broadly defined as the way a person's environment impacts their health. The opposite is true for the commercial determinants of health, which studies the way businesses impact public health. As one researcher bluntly put it, the field is all about, quote, when companies profit from making us sick. There's only one university in the U.S. with a program dedicated to it. You can literally count the number of U.S.-based experts on one hand. And there isn't a single mention of the commercial determinants of health on the Federal Health Department's website, according to Google. That's a shame because experts in the field agree the U.S. is doing a terrible job of addressing this very topic. Stat asked 10 global experts to grade the U.S.'s approach to grappling with all the ways that businesses drive sickness and death in the country. No one gave the U.S. grade a higher grade than C+, and several gave the nation an F. The list of offenders is numerous. First, there are industries themselves that directly and relatively obviously profit from poor health. Food makers behind ultra-processed foods, tobacco companies, the alcohol industry, and of course there are the lawmakers and regulators who fail to rein them in, and the industry of lobbyists who help maintain the status quo. Several also ding the energy sector, arguing that the country's reliance on fossil fuels and its role in climate change has and continues to make people sicker around the globe. One of the U.S.-based experts, SUNY's Nick Freudenberg, even spotlighted the financial industry. Their demand for regular quarterly profits and their predilection for moving capital with high speed leads many other industries, food, fossil fuel, housing, etc., to sacrifice long-term investment or balancing public and private needs with an insistence on short-term profits. The United States' relationship to the commercial determinants of health is all the more interesting and deserving of study because the nation, by and large, has stood up programs to try to tackle these issues. They're not just very good, the experts told Stat. Freudenberg gave the U.S. a C because he said the United States has attempted to regulate the financial, environmental, occupational, consumer practices of many businesses, but those same business interests have become a dominant voice in shaping those regulatory policies. May Van Schalowick, a researcher at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, gave the United States an F overall for its broad failures to regulate a whole host of industries. But she also noted that some past efforts concerning tobacco control and ongoing efforts to research the commercial determinants of health or to litigate against harmful industry practices are a definite A grade. Stat also asked the experts to recommend a single policy proposal that could be a first step towards reining in the health harms caused by businesses. Their answers included higher taxes on unhealthy products like tobacco, alcohol, and sugary drinks, increasing restrictions around corporate lobbying and the revolving door, and tightening antitrust enforcement. But two of the four U.S.-based experts had an even simpler answer: more study of the field stateside. The first step would be to acknowledge commercial determinants of health as a field and make it a priority to invest in researches and programs, said Nino Pachadze, the associate director of George Washington University Center of Commercial Determinants of Health. I think it's oddly paradoxical that the person who's running the Center on Commercial Determinants of Health thinks that that's the most important thing to do is invest in what he's doing. Well, whatever. This is Just for the Health of It, offering you fresh perspectives on 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And, of course, American healthcare, as it is, more likely sick care, is fraught with perverse incentives, and administrative waste is high on that list. This from Health Affairs. The role of administrative waste in excess U.S. health spending. Research points to administrative waste as a critical driver of excess health spending in the U.S. Top findings from the literature: administrative spending accounts for 15-30% of healthcare spending. The U.S. spends more on healthcare administration than comparable countries, and at least half of administrative spending is wasteful. For decades, the level and growth of U.S. healthcare spending has diverged from both international and domestic norms, leading many to characterize rising health expenditures as unsustainable. Between 1970 and 2020, total U.S. health spending grew from 6.9% of gross domestic product GDP to 19.7% of GDP, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, estimated that total health spending averaged 8.8% of GDP among member countries in 2019, compared with 16.8% in the U.S. That would be pre-pandemic. It obviously went up a little bit in the U.S. pandemic-wise. In their conclusion, they said, in evaluating interventions to address wasteful administrative spending, an important step is determining who must take action. The case for top-down intervention, rather than tweaking incentives to prompt the market to function better in the long term, is strong. This is particularly true in regard to standardization across diverse public and private sectors. It is notable that much of the literature on solutions to administrative waste proposes action by either the federal government or an agency created by that federal government. Perhaps because of a glaring market failure inherent to administrative costs, they are not generally borne by those imposing them. That's great to have costs that are borne by other people. And now we turn to a case study of sorts, this from Medical Express out of Great Britain, on the effects of austerity on health. Over 300,000 excess deaths in Great Britain attributed to UK government austerity policies. Recent evidence has shown people across the UK are dying younger as a result of austerity, with people living in the poorest areas hardest hit. A new study published now quantifies the scale of these deaths. The study, led by the Glasgow Centre for Population Health and the University of Glasgow and published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health, reports that compared to what previous trends predicted, an additional 335,000 deaths were observed across Scotland, England, and Wales between 2012 and 2019. The study adds to the growing evidence of the profound and deeply concerning changes to mortality trends observed as a result of the UK government's economic austerity policies. They have slashed billions of pounds from our public services and social security system, and with devastating impacts. Without support, people have been swept up in a rising tide of poverty and dragged under by decreased income, poor housing, poor nutrition, poor health, and social isolation, ultimately leading to premature death, now quantified in this new study. Dr. David Walsh, a lead author of the paper, stated these figures are not only shocking but shameful, and we must remember that these are more than just statistics. They represent hundreds of thousands of people whose lives have been cut short, and hundreds of thousands of families have had to deal with the grief and aftermath of those deaths. The tragic thing is that these deaths did not have to happen. In the words of the United Nations, in a society as wealthy as the UK, poverty is a political choice. The UK government needs to understand the damaging impact of austerity and respond with policies that put us back on the path of improving, not worsening, life expectancy for all. Co-author Professor Jerry McCartney, professor of well-being economy at the University of Glasgow, said, As the UK government debates current and future economic direction, it needs to understand and learn from the devastating effects that cuts to Social Security and vital services have had on the health of the population across the whole of the UK. The Scottish government must also do everything it can within its devolved powers to mitigate the effects of these UK government policies and help protect people from the disastrous consequences. Co-author Professor Ruth Dundas, Professor of Social Epidemiology at the University of Glasgow, added, "This study shows that in the UK, a great many more deaths are likely to have been caused by UK government economic policy than by the COVID-19 pandemic. We need to reverse the austerity policies and protect the income and therefore the health of the poorest and most vulnerable in our society." And next up from the New York Times, also getting at social determinants being more important than simple medical care. Medical care alone won't halt the spread of diabetes, scientists say. Over the past 50 years, medical advances have led to a more sophisticated understanding of the causes of type 2 diabetes and to an abundance of new tools for managing it. But better treatments have done little to stem the rise of the disease. 1 in 7 American adults has type 2 diabetes now, up from 1 in 20 in the 1970s. Many teenagers are developing what was once considered to be a disease of older people. 40% of young adults will be diagnosed with it at some point in their lives. Researchers who study type 2 diabetes have reached a stark conclusion. There is no device, no drug powerful enough to counter the effects of poverty, pollution, stress, a broken food system, cities that are hard to navigate on foot, and inequitable access to healthcare, particularly in minority communities. Our entire society is perfectly designed to create type 2 diabetes, said Dr. Dean Schillinger, a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. We have to disrupt that. Dr. Schillinger and nearly 24 other experts laid out a roadmap for doing so earlier this year in a comprehensive national report to Congress on diabetes, the first of its kind since 1975. It calls for reframing the epidemic as a social, economic, and environmental problem and offers a series of detailed fixes, ranging from improving access to healthy food and clean water to rethinking the design of communities, housing, and transportation networks. It's about massive federal subsidies that support producing ingredients that go into low-cost, energy-dense, ultra-processed, and sugar-loaded foods, the unfettered marketing of junk food to children, suburban sprawl that demands driving over walking or biking, all the forces in the environment that some of us have the resources to buffer ourselves against, but people with low incomes don't. We feel impotent as doctors because we don't have the tools to tackle the social conditions people are grappling with. The report, issued in January, calls for setting up a national policy office to roll out a far-reaching strategy to prevent and control diabetes. The document also pushes for greater involvement of federal agencies, like those regulating housing and urban growth. That may seem to have little to do with health, but could play a role in reducing the spread of the disease. The recommendations are intended to tackle the so-called social determinants of health, said Felicia Hill Briggs, Vice President for Prevention at Northwell Health. When we move beyond thinking of health as just biological disease, then we're able to see that the condition in which people are born, grow, work, live, and age play a very, very key role in influencing who gets disease and what the outcomes of that disease are. Being born into poverty should not determine whether you have access to food or green space or an educational system that works. Each patient with type 2 diabetes faces a cascade of risks, including painful nerve damage, vision loss, kidney disease, and heart disease, as well as foot and toe amputation. Type 1 diabetes, once called juvenile diabetes, carries many of the same risks but is believed to be an autoimmune condition. As of 2019, more than 14% of Native American and Alaskan Native adults had diabetes, according to the CDC. The figure for Black and Hispanic adults was about 12%, compared to 7.4% for white adults. Many of the recommendations now urged by diabetes researchers are both politically unpalatable and costly, but they could save money in the long run. 1 in 4 healthcare dollars goes to treat diabetes, and that costs the nation $237 billion annually, most of it paid for by government health plans, along with $90 billion in reduced productivity. Among the proposals, subsidies for farmers to grow healthy foods like fruits, vegetables, and nuts in order to make them more affordable. Paid maternity leave for working mothers so they can breastfeed, a practice associated with a lower risk of obesity and type 2 diabetes for both mother and child. Clear guidance from the government about the strong link between sugar-sweetened beverages and type 2 diabetes. Almost 1 in 10 nutrition-related programmed hours is spent on sweetened drinks, and the researchers recommend that government programs no longer pay for them. Improved nutrition labels that specify the amount of sugar in drinks in teaspoons, a measure that consumers can easily grasp, rather than grams. A 16-ounce Starbucks Frappuccino contains 11 teaspoons of sugar. A 16-ounce bottle of Snapple Raspberry Iced Tea has 9 teaspoons. The report also proposes hefty taxes of 10% to 20% on the price of sugary drinks. The beverage industry has aggressively fought similar efforts in the past. The conflict between the food industry and researchers has raged for decades, but the fast-spreading epidemic of type 2 diabetes has lent greater urgency to questions about improving what Americans eat. Healthy, unprocessed food is more costly, which has led some providers to up their own free pantries so that patients with food prescriptions can pick up produce, beans, and items like cans of low-sodium turnip greens. The report authors also want to make it easier for patients with people at risk of type 2 diabetes to take in-depth courses to learn how to manage and prevent the disease. Doctors often say that managing diabetes is like having a full-time job. So much of that last article had to do about the unhealthy food system. Got this next article from Stat News by one of my favorites, Marion Nessel, who's the author of Food Politics blog. In this article, FDA's plan to define, quote, healthy for food packaging better than the existing label anarchy, but do we really need it? The FDA has announced a set of rules it proposes to enforce for manufacturers to claim that a food product is, quote, healthy. The proposed rules are a lot better than the labeling anarchy that currently exists, but here's my bottom line. Health claims are not about health. They're about selling food products. The FDA says that a, quote, healthy product must meet two requirements. It must contain a meaningful amount of food, and it must not contain more than certain upper limits for saturated fat, sodium, and added sugars. To illustrate the healthy claim, the FDA is also researching a symbol that food makers can use and would be testing. Doing all this, the FDA says, would align healthy with the 2020 to 2025 Dietary Guidelines for Americans and with the nutrition facts label that is printed on food packages. This action is the latest in the FDA's attempt to simplify food label information so it is easier for consumers to identify healthier food choices. It is also an attempt to head off what food companies most definitely do not want, warning labels like those used in Chile, Brazil, and several other countries. These have been shown to discourage purchases of ultra-processed junk foods, just as they were supposed to, a message understood even by children or adults who cannot read. No wonder food manufacturers will do anything to prevent their use. If we must have health claims on food packages, the FDA's proposals are pretty good. They require any product labeled healthy to contain some real food, as opposed to a collection of chemical ingredients or, as author Michael Pollan calls them, food-like objects. And for the first time, they include limits on sugars. Here's an example given by the FDA. To qualify for the healthy claim, a breakfast cereal serving would need to contain at least 3/4 of an ounce of whole grains and will contain no more than 1 gram of saturated fat, 230 milligrams of sodium, and 2.5 grams of added sugars. These proposed rules would exclude almost all cereals marketed to children. But do Americans really need health claims on food products? You might think that any relatively unprocessed food from a plant or animal ought to qualify as healthy without needing FDA approval, and you would be right. But health claims aren't about health. They are meant to get people to buy food products, not real foods like fruit, vegetables, grains, nuts, meat, poultry, dairy, eggs, or fish. Food companies love the term healthy because it gets people to buy food products. The history of healthy. How did we get to where the FDA needs to require a product to contain real food to be considered healthy? Blame Kind Bars. In 2015, Kind, then a small private company but now owned by Mars, advertised its bars as healthy because it contained whole foods like grains and nuts. But nuts have more fat than the FDA allowed at the time for products to be labeled as healthy. The FDA warned Kind that its bars violated the rules for health claims. Kind fought back. It filed a citizen's petition arguing that even though nuts are higher in fat than the FDA allowed, they are healthy. The FDA could hardly argue otherwise. Of course nuts are healthy, and it backed off. It permitted Kind to use the term and said it would revisit its long-standing definition of healthy. That was good news for Kind. At the time, the FDA's definition of healthy set upper limits of fat, saturated fat, sodium, and cholesterol, required at least minimal amounts of one or more vitamins or minerals, and said nothing about sugars. So the new FDA proposals break new ground in simplifying the nutritional criteria and in putting a limit on sugars. Front of package symbols. These too have a long history with the FDA. In the early 1990s, when the agency was writing the rules for nutrition facts labels on food products, it tested public understanding of several prototype designs. As it happened, nobody could understand any of the samples very well, so the FDA picked the one that was the least poorly understood. Soon afterward, food companies and health organizations developed symbols that would allow buyers to recognize at a glance which products were supposed to be good for them. By 2010, there were more than 20 such symbols on food packages. The FDA commissioned the Institute of Medicine to do studies on front-of-package labeling. The Institute's first report on the subject examined the strengths and weaknesses of all the symbols cluttering up the labels of processed foods and recommended that the FDA develop a single symbol that would cover just calories, saturated fat, trans fat, and sodium. Why not sugars too? The Institute said calories took care of them. But the Institute's second report did include sugars. It recommended a front-of-package labeling system that would give food products 0, 1, 2, or 3 stars, or check marks, depending on how little they had of the undesirable nutrients. This idea so alarmed food manufacturers that they quickly developed the FACTS Up Front labeling system in use today. This, in my view, is so obfuscating that nobody pays any attention to it. But this scheme, coupled with industry pushback, was all it took to get the FDA to drop the entire idea of a symbol that would tell people what not to eat. Here we are a decade later with the FDA's current proposal. This plan is strong enough to exclude huge swaths of supermarket products from self-identifying as healthy. Products bearing the healthy symbol have to contain real food and be low in saturated fat, salt, and sugar, as called for by federal dietary guidelines. The new rules won't stop healthy products from being loaded with additives and artificial sweeteners, and the FDA won't require warning labels for unhealthy products, which works better than other symbols. But these proposals are a marked improvement over the current situation. And the FDA might do more. It could look into the idea of warning labels. It already promises to make a decision about the other ambiguous marketing term, natural. A decision on that one can't come soon enough. As for healthy, the FDA is seeking feedback on its proposals, which can be made until December 28th of this year. I can't wait to see what companies wanting to sell ultra-processed food products as healthy will have to say about this. And an editorial post note on this is that actually the wildly overwhelming majority of foods in a supermarket will not actually qualify as healthy given this definition that perhaps deserves a yikes. Okay, well, while we're talking about diet, I wanted to slip in a story here about protein and particularly protein restriction. One of the things that is promoted as healthy is eat as much protein. You know, the more protein you get, the better. And that actually is not true, particularly when it comes to animal-based protein. That's the one that can be harmful. Of course, there's less protein in plant food, so even if you eat a lot of those pretty high protein things, you're not going to get super amounts. It's mostly meat and dairy and eggs and such that you can get high amounts of protein. But this next story from Medical Express gets also with a tie-in to the diabetes that we were talking about earlier. Protein restriction can be effective in combating obesity and diabetes, study suggests. Cutting protein intake can help control metabolic syndrome and some of its main symptoms, such as obesity, diabetes, and high blood pressure, according to a study conducted by researchers in Brazil and Denmark to compare the effects of protein and calorie restriction diets in humans. The article reporting the study is published in the journal Nutrients. Metabolic syndrome is a cluster of conditions that heighten the risk of cardiovascular disease, stroke, and diabetes, including high blood pressure, high blood sugar, excess body fat around the waist, and abnormal cholesterol levels. The study shows that cutting protein intake to 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight was sufficient to achieve almost the same clinical results as restricting calories, but without the need to reduce calorie intake. The results suggest that protein restriction may be one of the key factors leading to the known benefits of dietary restriction. Protein restriction diets may therefore be a more attractive nutritional strategy and easier to follow for people with metabolic syndrome, said Raphael Faraz Bennett, first author of the article, and currently a postdoctoral researcher at the Joslin Diabetes Center in Harvard Medical School. This research would also line up with the plug of what I would consider the optimal diet for human health, which is a whole foods plant-based diet. Okay, well, I wanted to close the regular reporting on this episode with some good news, and this is a follow-up to a story that I reported on earlier, this from Stat News. Call it Data Liberation Day. Patients can now access all their health records digitally. The American Revolution had July 4th. The Allies had D-Day. And now U.S. patients, held down for decades by information hoarders, can rally around a new turning point, October 6, 2022, the day they got their health data back. Under federal rules taking effect last Thursday, healthcare organizations must give patients unfettered access to their full health records in digital format. No more long delays, no more fax machines, no more exorbitant charges for printed pages. Just the data, please, now. My great hope is that this will turn the tide on the culture of information blocking, said Lisa Bari, CEO of Civitas Networks for Health, a nonprofit that supports medical data sharing. It's a ground-level thing to me. We need to make sure information flows the way patients want it to. That's the opposite of the situation now in place. Health systems, data networks, and the companies that sell electronic medical records determine how much data patients can access, when, and under what circumstances. Meanwhile, private data brokers make huge profits by amassing hundreds of millions of de-identified medical records and selling insights to drug companies, device makers, and insurers without patients' knowledge or consent. The new federal rules, passed under the 21st Century Cures Act, are designed to shift the balance of power to ensure that patients can not only get their data, but also choose who else to share it with. It is a jumping-off point for a patient-mediated data economy that lets consumers in healthcare benefit from the fluidity they've had for decades in banking. They can move their information easily and electronically and link their accounts to new services and software applications. To think that we actually have greater transparency about our personal finances than about our own health is quite an indictment, said Isaac Cohan, professor of biomedical informatics at Harvard Medical School. This will go some distance towards reversing that. Even with the new rules in place, health data experts said change will not be fast or easy. Providers and other data holders who have dug in their heels at every step can still withhold information under certain exceptions. And many questions remain about protocols for sharing digital records, how to verify access rights, and even what it means to give patients all their data. Does that extend to every measurement in the ICU, every log entry, every email, and how would it all get standardized? For months, patients have been able to obtain a minimum data set specified under federal law, and applications such as Apple Health Records have already dramatically expanded access. But the new rules throw open the floodgates to a much wider swath of information, including medical images, doctor's notes, genetic data, and other details normally kept under lock and key. It's really simple. I have access to all my data, and people need to make that available to me digitally at my request, said Harlan Krumholtz, a cardiologist at Yale University and founder of Hugo Health, a company that helps patients collect and organize their health data. He said it will take time for providers and other data holders to fully comply, especially since enforcement remains spotty and unclear under the new rules. But patients' ability to get their data means they can better understand their care, shop for services, and participate in research without waiting for a clinician or drug company to present them with an opportunity. I hope it will become clear that we need to switch from a paternalistic system, where a lot of data is moving behind people's backs and without their permission or knowledge, to one where people have more control and agency over their data, Krumholtz said. Now, patients can have their own personal repository of data, and they can build on and ferry from one healthcare setting to another. A growing number of data companies are popping up to help them in that quest, seeking to act as fiduciaries for consumers who want access to their records, but don't have time or technical savvy to wade through the bureaucracy. This new environment is a radical departure from the status quo. For decades, it's been all but impossible for patients to quickly and easily access their records. Hospitals and other organizations are loath to relinquish that information for a couple of business reasons. It makes it easier to retain patients in their care, and it keeps them in control of information with high commercial and research value. The federal law known as HIPAA requires that providers turn over records when patients ask for them, but such requests are often met with delays, fees, and sometimes requests that they fetch them via fax. HIPAA has been in place for a long time, Bari said, but is simply not respected and used in that way. The roadblocks make it harder for patients like Liz Salmi, who has brain cancer and to get the care they need. For the first 8 years of her cancer treatment, she sought care at Kaiser Permanente in California, but a change in insurance coverage meant she eventually had to switch to new providers. I naively thought that because they were all on Epic, they could easily share my records, Salmi said. But she found out that their computer systems didn't talk to each other, so one hand didn't know what the other was doing. She ended up going to the medical records office at Kaiser in person to request copies of her records. They said, okay, what part of your record do you want? Lab results, visit summaries, Salmi recalled. I said, no, I want everything. She was told her full record, comprising 8 years of care at Kaiser, was 4,823 pages. If she wanted it printed, she would have to pay 15 cents per page for a total of $723.45. Salmi said she opted to pay $45 for three DVDs instead. It was 2017, well into the era of streaming services, smartphones, and same-day delivery. But to read her medical records, Salmi had to buy an external hard drive to load the disk onto her computer. When she finally opened them, it was like experiencing healthcare for the first time. I had no idea there was a whole other narrative going on behind the scenes, Salmi said. I could see all the emails back and forth with my doctors. I could see my progress notes. There was so much I had forgotten as a patient, and here it was in black and white, because somebody had taken the time to write it down. I was blown away. Salmi, who is now undergoing treatment for a recurrence of her cancer, joined Open Notes, an organization that promotes data sharing, where she is director of communications and patient initiatives. She said the effective date for the new data rules marks an important milestone. But to have real impact, it must be accompanied by an education campaign to help patients understand their rights and the benefits of getting their data. Too many patients, she said, are unaware of the volume of information recorded about them or its value in an environment with new opportunities to participate in clinical studies and digital health services without leaving their communities or even their homes. Many also may be unaware of the security risks and how to separate reputable data users from swindlers. You need to see and experience your health records to even know that what you'd be sharing, she said. But for years, a decision was made for us. You can see this, but you can't see that. When I peeled back the curtain and actually could see what was there, I said, oh my gosh, this is incredible. I want to keep reading. I wish I knew this sooner. Okay, well, a win for individual consumers and patients. Okay, and our last feature today is the bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for an increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. 26 bonus articles this week. First up, Four Alarm Blaze, New York Public's Health Crisis Converge, Monkeypox, Omicron, and Polio. So we've got a very thin public health infrastructure, and this is an example. You know, may be able to handle one epidemic at a time, but when you have more than one, things start to get real problematic. Two, new infectious threats are coming. The U.S. probably won't contain them. Yikes. Three, will there be a supreme assault on public health? This is a great overview of the issues now before the Supreme Court and how they'll affect public health. Four, suicide is complicated. So is prevention. This is a great background piece on understanding suicide and its prevention. It is complicated, but worth looking into. Five, a grim new reality, intimate partner violence after Dobbs and Bruin. So Dobbs obviously was the one that overturned Roe versus Wade, and Bruin was a New York case that got rid of a lot of restrictions on carry conceal guns. So intimate partner violence is a huge issue, and it's only been complicated by both of these Supreme Court decisions. Six, abortion ban skirt a medical reality. For many teens, childbirth is a dangerous undertaking. And perhaps not oddly, most of this is occurring in states with the highest teen pregnancy rates. Where you line up abortion bans with high teen pregnancy rates, you're going to get a lot of dangerous childbirth occurring. Seven, who obtained abortions in Ohio last year? This is a great backgrounder to get a profile of who the folks getting abortions in Ohio were last year. And one teaser, 57 of those were younger than 15. So more than one a week, 14 years or younger, got an abortion last year. And of course, that's illegal now. So you'd have to travel over the state. And we've seen the problems that has caused. Eight, privacy stigma may keep workers from using abortion travel benefits. So it's great that, corporations can offer that, but the privacy and stigma issues may keep workers from actually using them. 9. State medical boards may be a roadblock to wider telemedicine abortion. The U.S. is one of the few countries that has, you know, 50 different medical boards, which can really complicate doing things interstate. And telemedicine abortion is just one example of that. 10. Risking everything to offer abortions across state lines. So this is providers who are risking a lot legally to make abortion accessible across state lines. And a few COVID stories here. 11. From BQ1.1 to XBB and beyond, how the splintering of Omicron variants could shape COVID's next phase. So there's been a lot on this, but this is one of the better articles that really gives a good overview of how these variants could shape the future of COVID. 12. Warning signs about the first post-pandemic winter. It may not be as bad as last year's, but it certainly won't be good. 13. Biden's Operation Warp Speed revival stumbles out of the gate. So the U.S. is falling behind quickly from other nations in developing next-generation vaccines. And this could be like even the ones that are delivered to nose that could be more effective. And obviously, you don't need to get a needle prick either. That's kind of nice for a lot of people. But we ain't doing it because basically the Republicans aren't allowing any more money to be spent on COVID. 14. Long COVID has forced a reckoning for one of the medicine's most neglected diseases, chronic fatigue syndrome. There's only a handful of people that are experts on that, but this seems to be one of the manifestations of long COVID is chronic fatigue syndrome or things that look like it. 15. The monkeypox virus is mutating. How worried are scientists? This is another great background piece if you're interested in delving into immunology and mutating viruses. Another monkeypox story. 16. The black CDC scientists who couldn't get monkeypox treatment. So here's an expert working in the CDC, but of course he's black, which also creates other inequity issues. So an interesting story there. 17. Addiction experts fear the fallout if California legalizes sports betting. So requests for seeking treatment for sports addiction increases when you legalize sports betting in states, increases a lot. And actually, in the most recent year, with a bunch of states increasing the legalization, there's been like a 50% increase in like calls to like the addiction hotlines and such. It makes a difference, and it's another addiction that often isn't considered. But if you're into other real-time betting, 18, sign of the times, U.S. stocks up on radiation sickness drug. So this is happening all while, you know, while Putin's all talking about, you know, using nuclear weapons. And of course, we've got, you know, nuclear power plants that might go. So yeah, we're playing Russian roulette. And on that front too, 19, methane emissions may be 5 times higher than previously thought. Yeah, perhaps the biggest Russian roulette game of all is climate change. And that also interfaces with healthcare in an interesting way. Bonus story 20, Hurricane Ian shows that coastal hospitals aren't ready for climate change. So they get inundated, and not only do they get inundated with patients, but they get inundated with climate change, and they can't provide care for the patients, so it's a double whammy. 21, the cash monster was insatiable, how insurers exploited Medicare for billions. And in a related story, 22, nursing home surprise. Medicaid Advantage plans may shorten stays to less time than Medicare covers. Another example of how Medicare Advantage plans are a disaster. 23, poll documents how Americans think the U.S. healthcare system is failing them. Very good if you're interested in the nuance behind all that. 24, advocates cheer Biden marijuana decision, but call for legalization. 25, voices from the White House Conference on Hunger Nutrition, a bunch of different perspectives of that conference that just happened. And some more information that you can use. Lastly, 26, 5 things to do in your 20s and 30s to reduce your risk of preventable cancer. This applies, of course, to all ages, but since a lot of younger folks don't think about it very much. 1, don't smoke. 2, practice safe sex to avoid HPV infection. 3, maintain a healthy weight. 4, drink less alcohol, and 5, wear sunscreen to prevent the most common cancer of all, skin cancer. You can read these and the other stories I've reported on by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me. my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-